We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
We started out by talking a lot of Cubs. Just very pleased with Kyle Hendricks' performance by game score. The fourth best start he's had in his career. Looking a little bit at the numbers of Anthony Rizzo's struggles, especially against lefties, we looked at his splits. We talked about the Ken Rosenthal report that the Cubs might be in the market for a veteran leader, perhaps an outfielder. Not quite sure if that report makes a whole lot of sense. And Jeff Sullivan talked to us about the Cubs and baseball and other things as well. Also, Javier Baez, who apparently is attractive to people of all persuasions, orientations, races, creeds, and colors.
I don't know if you caught this. It certainly slipped under the radar the last couple of days for me, and now has resurfaced some just a bit. Have you seen what the 76ers have tried to do retroactively with the LeBron signing in L.A. conversation?
Yeah, they're making it clear. They're trying to burnish their attractiveness by talking about how seriously LeBron considered joining them.
This from the ESPN piece, speaking about their meeting with James agent Rich Paul and Clutch Sports at the start of free agency. Sixers managing partner Josh Harris and coach and interim manager Brett Brown reflected on the Sixers' chances of James teaming with Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. "I think they considered us very strongly," Harris said of James Group Monday at the Las Vegas Summer League. I would be speculating on how he makes his decisions, and I don't want to do that, but I think they were really serious about Philadelphia. The fact that they took the meeting with us was something they didn't view lightly, so I think that they were very serious about it. I brought this up when LeBron signed. I brought this up really when DeMarcus Cousins signed too in L.A. Or I'm sorry, with the Warriors. You got to wonder what the Sixers situation would have been like had Brian Colangelo not gone off the deep end and managed a bunch of shadow Twitter accounts and gotten himself fired for doing so. You have to wonder about it. Because whether that means LeBron is an actual possibility or them moving on Jimmy Butler is something they're able to do, or maybe even a Kyrie thing. They've got possibilities because they've got assets and ammunition to go after things. However, this is delusion. I mean, this is just, no. No. It didn't happen this way. That's not what happened.
I don't know what they think the advantage is then of going out and trying to spin this. What you're trying to win.
We're not that screwed up. We're not, I promise. That's all this means. That this is it's a front office that, in my opinion, took far too long to make a decision on Colangelo in the first place. Though even if they did make a quick one, they were still going to be in disarray once this process came around. But this
we
is
predicted they would be. We
Absolutely.
Said that would be the kind of thing where somebody like LeBron would look at it and go,
of course, no, thank you. No, right. I don't need any of this going on. But to be in a situation where you're just kind of gleefully handing out these quotes is just strange to me.
I believe we are now, if you're keeping count of the number of former Ohio State wrestlers / victims of Dr. Richard Strauss that have confirmed that Congressman Jim Jordan knew explicitly and specifically what was going on and that he's lying about not knowing, I believe we're at 8, despite the fact that
it's the count I had, yeah.
That the congressional professional chuds and Louis Gohmert and Steve Scalise have come out and said that all of these victims / wrestlers are lying, essentially saying every single one of them corroborating the Jordan's knowledge here. They're all lying. All the victims are lying about what happened to them. CNN's got another one as of this morning. Mm-hmm. Sarah Ganim, who, as you know, won the Pulitzer Prize for her work in reporting the Penn State story from Harrisburg, and then went to work for CNN. She has been one of the reporters involved in this. And there, this is a former OSU wrestler. Now, this is the latest, who is calling Jim Jordan a phony for saying he was not aware of any sexual abuse allegations. And he gets very specific about what the doctor did to him, how he was fondled, what he said to Jim Jordan, the number of other wrestlers that witnessed what he said. And I don't know how many people now is it going to take for people like Steve Scalise and other people in our government to understand that how many victims are you going to say are lying? How many of these people are going to say have manufactured after the fact, 14 years later, whatever it is, that they planted this seed as part of some conspiracy 14 years ago? And that now are saying, oh, no, this is all made up. Jim Jordan is telling the truth. No, he's clearly not telling the truth. He is clearly lying. Victims of sexual abuse are saying he is lying. They're all confirming the very same stories. What is it going to take for people to stop being awful about this? Stop being awful.
There's going to be more awful in this story, because as I'm sure you also saw, a number of coaches, assistant coaches, guys who were working together in that same staff also came out and defended Jim Jordan, saying that there was no way that nobody knew anything, nobody talked about anything, nobody heard anything. And from what it sounds like, is that the investigation, the independent investigation into Ohio State, acquired by Ohio State, asked to be done by Ohio State, not the NCAA, they've had trouble getting – Hellickson is the name of the head coach at the time.
Who has admitted that he understood there were problems. Right.
Brought it up at the time. They have had difficulty apparently interviewing Hellickson and getting him on the record here too. So there's more to this situation. There's more back and forth going to come out of this, and more than likely – more wrestlers going to come out and let people know that Jim Jordan has to have known
he
what was going
did
on.
He did know, and everyone's telling the exact same story about what he knew and how he knew, and then he's changing his story. Well, it was just locker room conversation. All the more reason. It doesn't matter where you heard it. It doesn't. That is the place where people are going to feel like they have someone's ear. You're a coach. You're a coach. And I know the mandated reporter statute only applies if we're dealing with minors, and that's been the talking point of Gohmert and others saying that these were grown men, so Jordan didn't have to do anything. I mean, right. Just the abdication of any moral responsibility for sex abuse victims here is so maddening, and it's just amazing to me how horrible people are being about this.
Sometimes sports makes us play in that world. It's got to be held in that kind of, that responsibility has to be held up to it. Sometimes it's an escape from other places like that, and it's kind of where we headed here in this next story. I've mentioned a couple of times that the NCAA football video game title run, one of my favorite things of maybe all time. It's one of the greatest sports games ever made, and I know that the fact it doesn't exist kind of sucks for a lot of video game fans. SB Nation and Alex Kirshner has a really cool story about how they're trying to keep a lot of people, gamers are trying to keep the game alive. It last came out 5 years ago. And on the anniversary of it coming out, July 9th, which was, of course, yesterday, he did a little story about how NCAA Football 14 with Denard Robinson on the cover is being kept alive by a bunch of gamers who just keep on playing it, and college football athletes who still enjoy playing it too.
Okay.
So there is apparently a whole community of people who will create, down to the looks of assistant coaches. You know, you can input your look of a coach one way or the other, and game this whole thing put together to give you, you know, Baker Mayfield last season at Oklahoma, or, you know, your next Ohio State team. I mean, they're getting the rosters all the way down to like the incoming freshmen and the recruiting trail.
It
is a hardcore community that is committed to NCAA football. And it's interesting because, yeah, as we've talked more and more about perhaps the one and done rule being let go by the NBA, we talk more and more about perhaps college football athletes getting paid for services, whether that's a unionization thing or not. It's possible that we get closer and closer to a video game being potential, because it is in and of itself a money-making enterprise. So maybe through that vehicle, you're able to get something for these athletes. It's a long shot as it stands because really one of the first cases that was brought against the NCAA and likenesses
had to do
it was O'Bannon. Right. It was exactly about – it was an NCAA basketball game at that point. But either way, it kind of rooked this of this of the EA football game too. I'd love to see it again. I played it for hours on end and recruited all the way until, you know, 2018 myself and in earlier versions of it. It's completely addicting and an awesome game, but worth reading. It's a piece in SB Nation by Alex Kirshner, in case you're into the game as I am.
I mentioned that I watched Travis Pastrana replicate the Evel Knievel jumps on Evel Live.
Yeah, still okay. Yet to watch that.
Yeah, you should check it out because he did the three Evel jumps. It was 143 feet over 52 crushed cars, 192 feet over 16 Greyhound buses, and then 149 feet clearing the Caesar's Palace fountain. Now, it's all great, and he did it to honor his hero. I mentioned as a kid, I was a huge Evel Knievel fan. He was a big deal. He was a big deal in the early and mid 70s. It was he was this icon. It looked too easy, is the point.
Oh no.
Travis Pastrana made me think, like, retroactively, when Evel missed the jump and broke every bone in his body.
Every single one of them.
It made it look like he gave his body attempting to do the impossible. It's like, oh, look at that. And then when Travis Pastrana does it so easily, you're thinking, you know, maybe Evel was bad at it. Maybe because he was the only guy trying it.
He was willing
to
do it.
How do we know? Isn't it, if we really think about it, maybe he wasn't any good at it. He was the Mr. Daredevil. He's the only guy willing to test life and limb to do something like this. But when here's the guy like, oh, yeah, okay. And he's knocking out these jumps in his sleep.
Right.
And I'm making them, trying to, all the run-ups and all the build-up, trying to make them look harder. The only reason we think it's hard is because Evel failed at it. It's possible he was bad at jumping things.
Is it like a Tiger Woods thing where the course needs to be lengthened? Like, is the equipment and the training and everything better, or do you think because Evel was the only guy doing it that he indeed was bad? I wonder. Like, did Pastrana have a better engine and a better bike and better ramps and better scientists? Because they got a whole team behind doing the math and everything.
Here, Pastrana jumped the fountain in the opposite direction Knievel did, with the area much more built out than it was on New Year's Eve in 1967. Pastrana had less space for his approach, leaving him a shorter distance to reach approximately 70 miles an hour before takeoff.
Weird.
So the difficulty degree was even higher. But we're sort of making Evel Knievel an icon just because it was only him.
He was going to put his body on the line.
Maybe he was bad.
This from the New York Post. The headline reads, "Man gored by bull while looking at car for sale." California man stripped by a used car Wednesday almost cost him his life after he came face-to-face with an aggressive bull. Walt Dean King went to check on a used car at a rural property in Tracy, located about 60 miles east of San Francisco, when he was suddenly knocked to the ground by the animal. I remember feeling the horn going through my right side, and the next thing I knew, I was on the ground, close to a bush. I crawled between the bush and the house, and the bull stood over me and snorted for about 20 minutes, King said. King, 69, told Fox 40 he didn't remember seeing the animal before getting knocked down to the ground, but remember being gored twice before someone stopped and honked a car horn. "It's the worst thing I've ever had. I've never hurt this bad," he said. "I've had broken legs, everything, and I've never hurt this bad, never, ever." After he was taken to the hospital, King underwent 3 hours of surgery on both sides of his stomach.
Where did the bull come from?
He told Fox 40 doctors, informed him that his belly fat saved him from an even worse injury and that he might not know the full extent of the damage for 6 months.
Oh, he's got to be on the I'm Fat podcast.
His belly fat saved him from his wounds. While a family member told the 69-year-old he had an angel there making sure he didn't bleed to death, King believes there was something else that kept him alive. It was karma. Because back in the 70s, I had pulled a lady out of a burning building, so now I think I'm being paid back by not dying. I think he might be right. It's the only thing I can say. I don't know why else. I shouldn't be here right now.
But thank the cheeseburger.
But yes, I am.
What happened, though? Right, ironically, thank all of the meat that he had eaten. But where did it come from?
I don't know. It's seemingly nobody knows. He's just out there. I mean, the news station went out there and took video of this lot, this empty car. It's not a lot. It's more like just like this ranch out in the middle of nowhere. And a bull's just walking by and gores him twice.
Cristiano Felicio found a use.
For all that money, he's finally worth it. That is the Midday Midway, brought to you by Subway. Wrap your hands around Subway restaurant's savory rotisserie-style chicken Caesar signature wrap. Enjoy tender rotisserie-style chicken topped off with savory Caesar sauce fit for an emperor. Try one today at Subway. We do have some developing news and some frightening photographs. Apparently, Bills running back LeSean McCoy is being accused of brutally beating his girlfriend and putting her in the hospital, from where there are some frightening pictures that are being posted at bustedcoverage.com. So I want to get to some of that. And also, it took in some summer league basketball. And when you watch summer league basketball, your mind tends to wander. And it brings people to talking about basketball games and ways to end basketball games. And there's a piece here by Joe Posnanski on The Athletic about a new concept for how to conclude basketball games that I think you might get a kick out of. And I thought, oh, this is going to be ridiculous. And the more I thought about it, the more I was convinced that it could be viable.
All that plus Cubs manager Joe Maddon coming up at noon. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
So apparently Shady McCoy is responding now to this story. This is a strange story. I want to make sure. There was a post that was on, I don't know exactly the social media origin of this. I'm going to read you from the website Busted Coverage. It said the news just dropped within the last couple hours. It's a huge accusation against LeSean McCoy. The Bills running back is being accused of beating up his girlfriend, Delicia Gordon, by one of Corden's friends. According to the friend, the beating took place this morning, and Ms. Corden is in the hospital. There's no secret he's had some trouble over the years, but there's a picture of a woman with scarring and swelling all around the head and face.
It's pretty graphic.
It's very graphic. It just says, "The devil, you are an animal. We didn't say anything about how you beat your dog into kidney failure, or the times my best friend had to stop you from viciously beating your son for small things." And they talk about illegal drug usage, all the steroids and needles. "We will not keep quiet. The world needs to know what type of animal you really are." But you say that he now, LeSean McCoy, is responding.
He has. On Instagram, he threw back a response. "For the record, the totally baseless and offensive claims made against me today on social media are completely false. Furthermore, I have not had any direct contact with any of the people involved in months." That's McCoy himself writing it, I presume. I mean, it's not put out through his agency. It's not on, you know, letterhead, or it's not affiliated with any team or whatever. It's his personal Instagram that he's thrown that statement out on.
All right, so something is not connecting here. If he's saying he's absolutely 100% not involved in this, That's a pretty strong denial.
It is, yeah, the strongest. I mean, it's got to be investigated. It's got to be looked into by a team, by the NFL itself. And if we know anything about how the NFL investigates these kind of things, I'm sure that it'll be botched
Forget the NFL. Whoever did this, this is beyond assault and battery. That could be in the realm of attempted murder. If you're looking at somebody being beaten that severely. So this isn't really an NFL issue yet, as much as it is a law enforcement issue. Who did this to this woman? If he did not,
you're right.
Right? Yeah. Forget the NFL for a moment, and let's actually find out if this just happened. Who did it? If he's saying he hasn't had any contact with these people, he's saying he wasn't near them and clearly is not responsible for this whatsoever,
and hasn't had any direct contact with these people in months, he says. So yeah, that would be a tough thing to try and line up.
Burstyn and McKnight brought to you by Northwestern Football. The Wildcats, coming off a 10-win season, host Michigan, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Notre Dame, and more this fall at Ryan Field. Season and single-game tickets are on sale now at nusports.com. So that's something, obviously, we're going to keep an eye on. It's very difficult to explain some of that or to have a strong opinion about it when we've got this divergent of stories being told. So I turned on the TV last night. I figure I'm going to take in some summer league basketball. Because it feels like basketball, and you just kind of want it on.
It does.
There was no White Sox game to lead us up to the Cub game, and the Cub game was starting so late that I needed something sportsy while I'm doing dishes. And
sounds like basketball. You get the singing and the bouncing and the shushing and the plotzing.
You've got all that. But you also had interviews going on over it because nobody actually wanted to describe the action.
Yeah.
They didn't want to bother telling you who was doing what because it was so bad. And it's as I'm clicking around, and I find this story about an outside-the-box idea to change the way basketball games end. Have you heard of this?
No.
Okay, have you heard of something called the Elam ending?
No.
All right, there's a guy named Nick Elam. He's a Ball State professor, a Mensa member, and a Cincinnati Reds groundskeeper.
What?
And this guy...
Is he a doctor of sax?
Maybe.
That too. He might be. Now, I want you to give this a chance, okay? So he believes that the ends of basketball games and getting rid of some of the things that are bad in sports, the list that Posnanski has here, he said the fouls at the ends of basketball games, intentional walks in the biggest moments in baseball, quarterbacks kneeling away the final minutes. He said we'd rather sidestep these potholes than even slightly change the rules. So this is just... be open-minded to this idea for a moment.
Okay.
And he came up with this idea to solve the problem of the ends of basketball games with what he calls the hybrid duration format.
Catchy.
And he said that's why the Elam ending is a little more catchy in that. And first understand the concept of how the way time is kept in sports. There's the rigid clock, the actual clock, and then there's virtual clocks. Essentially, he says, in golf, time is kept by holes. You play 18 holes to finish the round.
Sure.
NASCAR is timed by miles. In tennis, time is kept by points and games and sets. The first to win two or three, depending on the tournament, is the winner. In baseball, it's outs.
Of course.
You get your 27 outs, and if a team gets hit after hit, does not ever make the last out, the game could theoretically go on forever.
Okay.
Football, basketball, hockey, lacrosse, rigidly timed, soccer a bit less so. Basketball is the biggest slave to the clock in all of sports. Games sometimes come down to tenths or hundredths of a second because the sport is tied to time. There are only so many strategies a trailing team can come up with, and really, there's only one. The foul and hope they miss free throw strategy.
And then hit three.
And most of us hardly think about how crude and absurd it is. You're not supposed to foul people in basketball until you are. But here's what Elam imagined. Okay, you play basketball in the playground. What do? Does somebody keep a clock?
Nope.
No. You play to 11, win by two. You play to 21, make it, take it. You play to a score. Now you're looking at me. You're giving me the skunk eye here because you don't know what the other
well,
shoe
I've,
is.
I've just realized how much I hate watching all the fouls at the end of the game.
Everybody does.
Well, not just realized, but you're bringing to mind how much I dislike watching all the fouls at an end of a basketball game.
Okay. So.
So I'm open. I'm
so
willing.
Hold on.
I'm playing to a score.
Just wait.
All right.
This is the Elam ending. 3 minutes left in an NBA game and 4 minutes left in a college game. You turn off the clock.
I'm scared.
From that point on, you play to a target score. So ask the next question.
What's the target score?
This is the best part. It's the leading team's total plus 7.
What? Why?
So just wait here.
Okay.
This works. If the game is tied at, say, 89... then it's a mad dash to 96. If a team is leading 104 to 89, then the target is 111, meaning the trailing team would have to score 22 before the leading team scored 7. So Elam thinks of the fun that teams could have with the target score. Imagine a team bringing out a celebrity to announce it. Imagine the fun ways you could display it on the scoreboard. It's pretty exciting.
Right.
Maybe you don't think so. If your first reaction to the Elam ending, this is Joe Posnanski writing, is no way, or that's crazy, or it sounds interesting, but it could never work. Well, yeah, that's how most sports fans react to new ideas. Elam has heard it all. But Nick Elam is a thorough guy. He did research. Then he did more research, and then he did even more research, and he wrote a book, not just to sell, but to spread the word. He reached out to leagues. He sent letters. He sent emails. Discussions on internet forums, particularly that of stat guru Tom Tango, who was
really
well-regarded.
And anonymous.
And an advisor to the Cubs and other MLB teams. He took on all comers. So when people come at him with the complaint that the new ending would eliminate buzzer beaters, right? What about buzzer beaters? He responds with the precise number of buzzer beaters. He has sampled more than 2,900 games, college, the NBA, the Olympics, and found only 28 buzzer beaters. That's less than 1%
over, of all. Over what span of?
2,900 games. That's less than 1% of all games. So the buzzer beater doesn't deliver often enough to put up with constant fouling, the herky-jerky final 3 minutes of games, and the intense boredom of watching people shoot free throws. The Elam ending promises the chance for extraordinary comebacks, potential sudden death back and forths, high energy finishes night after night. Even a team up by 20 couldn't just cakewalk into the locker room. It has to score the victory bucket. So even if you're winning by a ton, you've got to knock down
seven.
You've got to knock down the game winner. It is so much better than a once and forever buzzer beater. And he brings up an aside. In this last NCAA tournament, one of the most extraordinary things in basketball history happened, right? A 16, UMBC, Maryland, Baltimore County, finally beat a number one Virginia. He says, I've waited for that all my life. And yet, what do you remember from that game?
Nothing.
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 Does anything stand out? A magical play? A memorable shot? A singular moment?
No, it was a constant grind.
What if the game had the Elam ending? Who would forget the final shot? The one that actually won the game. Who would forget the tension of those final 4 minutes when Virginia still had an outside chance and UMBC would have had to finish the job? It's a better way to end games. And then the next complaint is strategy. He said, it's the same complaint I hear whenever I gripe about the awfulness of intentional walks, but it's strategy. And Elam says strategy is a grown-up word. It should be used by grown-ups. A strategy is something where you should have other options to choose from, a different approach. With deliberate fouling, trailing teams don't have any options. And it almost never works. You can't call that a strategy with a straight face. But people talk about strategy, tradition, people not wanting to trample about what Dr. Naismith invented. He said, I see this effort as a tribute to him. The Elam ending is meant to compel teams to play the sport he invented and not this corrupted version.
It's an interesting couple of points. I like the idea of the final bucket. I don't know that I agree necessarily with the buzzer beater point, though, because just because a buzzer beater doesn't go in, when what was the number again? 29,000 games?
So probably 1% of games.
1% of games. All right, we'll stick with that. 1% of games. Just because a buzzer beater doesn't go in doesn't mean that there wasn't value added to the game. You think back to Butler's buzzer beater against Duke, the Gordon Hayward shot, that it didn't go in.
Right.
But the fact that that got lifted up was incredible to begin with, that you even got there to that point. So I don't know. I guess I'd like to see a little bit different math done on that. That said, you still get the victory bucket every single time.
Exactly.
You still get that feeling.
You've got to get there.
You've promised me that shot every single game.
Somebody's got to ice it.
And yeah, but how many times, if it's the 20-point deficit, I'd love to know in those 2,900 games, how many times did the winning team not get three or four buckets in that final 4 minutes?
But they're not trying. You can't really...
Exactly. So I would love to see the number with them not even trying to see where that is on the spectrum.
Because you assume it'd go up once they start to try.
Yeah, but you can't measure what they've done in those games because they weren't incentivized to do the same things.
I'm not saying it's an exact... I would just like a beginning data point on that is what I'm saying. I just want anything. I want a reference point.
What you need to do is something like the Big Three or in some lower level, you need to experiment with it. The only way to get that data for it is to actually do it.
Right.
The Big Three plays to a number. And you know what happens with the teams that are winning? They get to the number first and it's not that compelling. It's just waiting for the inevitable.
But that's a straight number. That isn't the lead at a certain point plus
it's true.
Whatever.
That's true.
Right? That's just the target number.
Because that values the rest of the game
correct.
To a certain point.
Right. This is an adjustment.
A large point,
right.
Really.
It, otherwise you're just going to get, there's no point playing any of the other minutes before that if it's just going to, at that point, be a race to a number. It's all right, start now, first team to 21 wins.
If it is,
I just think he's romanticizing it a little much to sell his point. I think he's romanticizing it just a bit.
Maybe, but it would keep defense in the game, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't necessarily take an entire strategy of shooters and, like, you know, line them up on the, you know, like the NBA game is now. You have to keep the other team from scoring that seven to begin with.
What I was also thinking, too, was it may not take intentional fouling out of it. Because there still may be, if there's a bad free throw shooter out there, it still might be your best bet. If you look at points per possession,
coaches will find a ways around everything.
Right. There might still be a way to game it that could still involve more herky jerky endings than you think, because it's not a coach's job to play along with how telegenic the sport is. It's the coach's job to try to win the game.
Yeah, put actual strategy out there and grab a dub.
Right. I thought it was very cool, though.
It is interesting.
And the guy's a crusader for it, that he wants everybody to just take him seriously enough to listen.
There's definitely something quixotic about it. And if nothing else, we appreciate that on the show. I like this idea more and more I think about it. I really do. 4 minutes left in the NCAA is the mark, because I assume they're poorer shooters and you need more time to find
last
your
TV
7 points
too.
Or whatever. Oh yeah, that's your last TV too. So you get to keep, you hold everybody hopefully through it.
Mm-hmm.
It would just be, so you just turn off, no clock. There is no, what Chiron then, what graphics do you have to show so that it's just a run to seven? It's almost like a soccer shootout thing where you're lighting, you know, just on your way to 7 points.
Like a bar graph maybe?
Yeah, maybe a bar, you're building your way, like a task bar. You know, building your way there to wherever you have to get to. And there's some good points here. It might be that teams could begin intentional fouling leading up to the point the clock is turned off. That once you've changed the actual time stoppage moment, the end of the small g game,
right,
that then you would have an end game strategy to prepare yourself for the Elam ending. That's a good point, too. This segment brought to you by Walgreens. Walgreens is here for all your diabetes needs. Stop by today to consult with your pharmacist and get trusted advice and tips about your diabetes medications and testing supplies. And the reason why I brought this up in the context of Summer League basketball is, why not in Summer League? This is the perfect time and place to do it. Absolutely brilliant. It's dog-ass basketball anyway.
It's so bad.
It's so horrible that you're not sacrificing anything. You could learn a lot about your play. You're getting your players to try harder in some garbage moments. Why not do this in NBA Summer League?
I'd watch.
Yeah.
I mean, to see some of that happen and see some of the novelty.
I would,
absolutely.
Too. Yeah. I had it on anyway, you know, because it's sort of a loose simulacrum of NBA basketball-ish.
That's altogether unsatisfying when it comes down to the end.
Completely.
Okay. I know you've watched some Summer League basketball. When's the last time you watched to the end of a Summer League basketball game?
I can tell you when, and it was awesome. And it was two summers ago, and my son and I were staying at Lake Lawn Lodge and Lake Delavan. And we were going to bed early because we were getting up early the next day to do our guided Lake Geneva fishing trip with our buddy JT. And it was the Sixers and the Lakers, and it was the McConnell. Is it TJ McConnell?
Okay.
And he was dueling with Russell, D'Angelo Russell. And the game was bananas. Highly competitive, amazing shots, trading baskets, came down to the buzzer beater, and D'Angelo Russell hits this crazy shot, and he's slapping his forearm like ice water, ice in my veins. And then he swore. They brought the microphone over immediately after the game, and he's like, I played like horse bleep the first half, and now I had to come out there. It was an incredible game. We were jumping up and down.
It's 1% of Summer League games then that come out to be actually interesting
there,
at all.
I answered your question.
I have asked and you have answered. There's more breaking NFL news this morning and now into the afternoon. We got Joe Maddon coming up at noon, but the NFL Players Association has issued a statement in light of the anthem policy that the owners have put out just a couple of weeks ago. So we have to get to that when we come back. It's Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Bernstein and McKnight, middays on the score, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Tuesdays at noon, we talk to Joe Madden, and we look forward to doing that today as well.
Little news from the NFL Players Association. They have tweeted out the following statement. Our union filed its non-injury grievance today on behalf of all players, challenging the NFL's recently imposed anthem policy. The union's claim is that this new policy, imposed by the NFL's governing body without consultation with the NFLPA, is inconsistent with the collective bargaining agreement and infringes on player rights. In advance of our filing today, we propose to the NFL to begin confidential discussions with the NFLPA Executive Committee to find a solution to this issue instead of immediately proceeding with litigation. The NFL has agreed to proceed with those discussions, and we look forward to starting them soon. So not quite the titanic shift that they could have made this. Again, like it mentions in the statement, they're not going directly to litigation, which apparently is well within the Players Association rights to do, considering they were held out of negotiations about this rule or any kind of consultation about the, absolutely, right. It could still end up there. But this is what, I mean, beyond what you thought of the politics of this, beyond what you think a player should or should not be allowed to do in the workplace, if they are indeed in the workplace when they're at some of these stadiums, which are on public ground and might not have the defense of an employer being allowed to do this or that as an employee. The mere fact that NFL ownership and the commissioner's office chose to either ignore the fact or not realize the fact that the NFL Players Association were going to have words about this and be upset that they and their constituent act were left out of this negotiation, a negotiation which clearly enough players were invested in and involved in to want to do something during the anthem itself.
Don't forget that it was also after they made a very public show of saying, we want to listen to you, we want to work on something, come talk to us, let's figure something out, that was completely disingenuous.
Here's our new policy that you had nothing to do with and didn't know was coming. To be quite honest, I don't know why it took this long for the NFL Players Association to put this out. I know they issued a statement right after the policy was announced that we're not happy about this and we're exploring our options and strategy and what have you. This is a little tepid, to be honest with you. I find this just to be a little bit, I don't know, maybe they do hope to actually negotiate in good faith about this and have some sort of rule put together.
Maybe they got an indication
the players can live with
that there would be some more receptive response and agreed to do it this way rather than trying to pick up the bigger hammer. Maybe there was some outreach before filing a grievance, say, look, if we do this and we go through this process, might we expect it to be more productive than if we take strongly adverse positions and rack up a lot of legal fees?
Stands to reason. I would also wonder whether, you know, legal fees or prolonged litigation aside, I would also wonder whether the fact that you've had, you know, the most vocal person in the country about the anthem policy has not shown any willingness to stop knocking the NFL, regardless of what that policy is. Each time they've come out, the ownership and then the commissioner's office, each time they come out with some sort of, whether it's this policy or statements prior that led up to this policy, the president has said more and more about this anthem issue to begin with. And if this policy was made so as to dodge heat from that office and from that podium, that clear, they have not gotten the kind of response that they'd hoped that policy would give them. So maybe finally you're waking up to the fact that you're going to catch heat on this from that guy as often as he wants to.
No matter what, just because.
And again, this isn't – I understand that this is a politically divisive issue, right? That you've got people on either side of this, and what's right and what's wrong here is definitely a hot-button issue. You can think whatever you want, I guess. No one's going to stop you one way or the other. But what's refuting the fact that the president has brought heat on the NFL over and over again on this issue is nonsensical. He has. So there's a push and pull reaction here. There's an equal and opposite reaction here that's worth monitoring. And clearly the NFL, as an organization, felt pressured enough to make something happen without the input of its players. And that's got the Players Association ticked off.
And it it was at a time where they didn't have to do anything as the story happened to be cooling and congealing into something else, where they decided for whatever reason to rip the scab off because they have an unbelievable ability to shoot themselves in the foot, and they proved it again with that. The latest on the LeSean McCoy situation, which, as we say, is fluid, there was the graphic Instagram post of what appears to be his girlfriend beaten badly around the head and face and scarred and scabbed. And LeSean McCoy is saying that, for the record, the totally baseless and offensive claims made against me today on social media are completely false. He says he has not had any direct contact with any of the people involved for months. Pro Football Weekly has reached out to the Bills, the NFL, and McCoy's agent, Drew Rosenhaus, for comment. The team, the league, and Rosenhaus have not yet responded. Diana Rossini of ESPN reported that the team is aware of the matter and is looking into it. So that's the latest that we know. And as we learn of developments, we will let you know as well. We know that next up, the manager of the Chicago Cubs is going to join us. We're going to talk baseball and sports and things with Joe Maddon on The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.